From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's not easy to sit back and watch innocent civilians die on the streets of Syria. It's not easy to ignore the pleadings of your Middle East allies to get involved in that civil war. The Obama administration has pretty much done that until now. But like a Greek tragedy, destiny seems to be pushing the U.S. deeper into that conflict. This hour On Point, arming Syria's rebels and America's options. You can join us this hour. Do you welcome the decision to send arms to the rebels? Do you think it's about time, too little, too late, or a terrible mistake? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Amman, Jordan, is CBS News correspondent Clarissa Ward. She's been covering this war, traveling to the battlefronts and refugee camps for CBS News. She recently won a Peabody for her work. Clarissa, welcome. Congratulations.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much.
You've done such great reporting from inside Syria. Give us a reaction from both the Assad regime and from rebel fighters about President Obama's decision to send weapons to the Syrian opposition.
Well, I think the first reaction that the rebels had was that they couldn't quite believe what they were hearing on their TV sets. They were genuinely surprised to see what promises to be perhaps a significant shift in the United States policy in Syria. At this stage, I'd say they're very pleased and they're optimistic, but they're also not letting themselves get carried away. They're concerned that perhaps this is more about paying lip service to the rebels and about coming down against the Assad regime and against Hezbollah and Iran rather than a commitment to supply the rebels with the heavy weapons, the anti-tank and anti-aircraft weapons that they say they need in order to bring about the downfall of the Assad regime. Now, for the government's part, they call the U.S. intelligence on chemical weapons a caravan of lies. The Russians also coming out against any shift in U.S. policy towards providing weapons or any type of military support for the rebels. So unsurprisingly, they are staunchly against this move. But I think everybody's sort of waiting to see how exactly this plays out and whether this really is a sincere and definitive shift in policy or whether this is more geared towards trying to get the rebels and the opposition to the table, the negotiating table, at a peace conference, which had been scheduled for next month in Geneva, but now appears to be sort of uncertain.
Mm. Exactly what kind of military aid are we talking about, Clarissa? You mentioned heavy weapons. What kind of weapons will the U.S. be sending?
Well, this is the million-dollar question, and so far the U.S. has been very, very vague and very cagey about what type of military, I mean, the word they use or the phrasing they use is military support, not actually weapons. But from what I understand from my various sources, the U.S. will likely be providing sort of lighter weapons along the lines of, AK-47s, although at the moment, they chose these words military support. As I said, it looks like it might even be more things like night vision goggles or armored vehicles or, bulletproof vests, things of that nature. The question, of course, as well is whether or not the U.S. will get more involved in training the rebels. There are reports out there that the CIA has a training program with the Jordanians here in Jordan. It's been difficult to confirm those reports yet, but certainly a lot of people are talking about the possibility of selecting the rebels that seem the most, attuned to U.S. values and providing them with the training they need to use weapons, but also just in terms of tactics and strategies going ahead, trying to make some gains against the Assad regime.
Hmm. Remind us what prompted this new policy, Clarissa.
Well, I think there was a sort of confluence of events. That perhaps the most important strategic thing, change on the battlefield was the fact that Hezbollah, which is, as you know, a Lebanese Shiite militia backed by Iran. The U.S. regards it as a terrorist organization. Hezbollah finally publicly fully entered the fight in Syria. And this is very significant to see Hezbollah's leader throw his weight publicly behind the Syrian people and actually be willing to pay for that in blood. We're hearing that hundreds of Hezbollah fighters were killed in the battle for the town of Qusair. Qusair is a border town between Syria and Lebanon. It's enormously valuable from a strategic point of view because it's a supply route where rebels were able to get weapons or food or whatever supplies they needed, medical aid, through to other parts of southern Syria. So the fact that Assad, with the help of Hezbollah, enjoyed such a triumph in Qusair really, I think, rattled a lot of people and a lot of onlookers in the international community, and dare I say, perhaps in the White House too. And certainly the rebels that I have spoken to tell me that's very much the approach that they've taken when they've gone to the White House and they're lobbying for more support. They seem to think that the Achilles heel that they managed to find, or the sort of cord that resonated with the U.S. was, listen here, Hezbollah's in the fight, Iran's in the fight, and they're going to beat us, and there'll be nothing left of the opposition, and you're going to have a very strong nexus of, Iran back Syria, Iran and Hezbollah. And it seems a lot of people in the international community don't necessarily want to see that. Certainly the U.S. does not appear to want to see that. So many people are speculating that that is probably one of the decisive factors in the timing of this. As for the intelligence regarding chemical weapons, that's been sort of floating around for quite some time now, a few months. I'm sure you remember the British came out and said they found their intelligence led them to conclude weapons were used, the Israelis, the French, even the Americans as well, a couple of months ago, or just about 6 weeks ago, I guess it was, in April, announced that it looked like chemical weapons had been used. So certainly many are speculating that the chemical weapons may be more of a pretext for getting involved as opposed to the actual decisive, this is why we're getting involved. Mm-hmm. But that's speculation.
You've reported, Clarissa, that the Syrian rebels, you mentioned Hezbollah now in this fight, in the past have been very disorganized, fragmented. Many al-Qaeda fighters have joined this uprising in significant numbers. How much of a concern is there now that U.S. weaponry, whatever it may be, could fall into the wrong hands?
Well, I think it's a huge concern. I think that, unfortunately, there are a lot of people who will say this is too little and it's too late. Well, you can argue about the first point, but the second point, I think, is definitely something to take on board. If one did want to arm the rebellion, perhaps the time to have done it would have been a year ago. And I only say that because as the rebels turned to the U.S. and turned to the international community and asked for help and found that it wasn't forthcoming, they basically opened themselves up to accepting help and training and fighters from more extremist non-state actors, such as Jabhat al-Nusra, which has affiliations and ties to al-Qaeda in Iraq, were sort of born out of the vacuum that was created by really the lack of response from the international community. And the question now is, as much as people say, oh, we can just arm these rebels and we won't arm those rebels, well, if you've spent time in Syria, as I have, on the front lines with these rebels, you'll see that they all fight together, all these different groups, and there really isn't such a distinctive separation between the different brigades. In fact, many fighters don't necessarily affiliate themselves with any one particular group. They might have their village gang, and they will fight with different groups each week depending on who has more money, who has more weaponry. So when you're dealing with a very fluid situation like that where you have all these different groups and none of them really in any sort of coherent order, there's no clear chain of command, which is another concern. Obviously, it is potentially a dangerous situation to be giving heavier weapons, if we were to be talking about heavier weapons, to people like that without being able to guarantee where they will end up. So I do think it's a concern. I also think that perhaps in the media or perhaps certain parties have maybe overplayed the extent to which the rebels and the uprising in Syria has become radicalized. because as is always the case, when you have just a few people behaving in the same in a certain way that's much more eye-catching, they're going to galvanize public attention, and they've been very successful in frightening people. That said, on the other hand, I also don't see what you might class as secularists on the ground in the Syrian rebellion. You simply don't see it all. And there are moderates there, absolutely. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. It is murky, murky waters indeed.
We have about a minute left to the break. Clarissa, give us a timetable for all of this. Just a couple of weeks ago, the U.S. was suggesting that American shipments of non-lethal aid to the rebels was still weeks away. So what's the timetable on this announcement of military aid now?
Well, we don't really have an answer on that again. I mean, we still haven't even heard President Obama come out and discuss all this and explain what exactly is meant by it. I'm here in Jordan where these joint exercises between the Jordanian and American military are taking place, and the American officers that I'm speaking to here are seem to be as much in the dark as we all are. So certainly I don't think you would expect anything imminently. But that's really just going on conversations I've had with rebel leaders who also say they're not entirely sure when or if they can expect major changes either.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about next moves for the U.S. into the Syrian civil war, arming the rebels, and maybe more to come. Here's some sound from a conference call on Thursday when Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes told reporters American aid in Syria will help improve the position of rebels on the ground and seemed to hint that the administration was responding to pressure from its allies in the region.
That is something we are have decided to move forward with. And we are going to do so in consultation with and cooperation with other countries in the region.
And here's White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday. Even as the administration gets more involved in Syria, McDonough says caution is necessary.
We have to be very discerning about what's in our interest and what the outcome, what outcome is best for us, and the prices that we're willing to pay to get to that place. We've rushed a war in this region in the past. We're not going to do it here.
I've been speaking this hour with CBS News correspondent Clarissa Ward. She's in Amman, Jordan, and I'd like to bring two more voices into the conversation now. Joining me first from Washington is Michael O'Hanlon, Director of Research for the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. Michael, welcome to you.
Thank you, Jane.
Also joining me from Washington is Paul Pillar. He's had a 28-year career in U.S. intelligence, serving in the CIA, the National Intelligence Council, and much more. He's now a non-resident senior fellow of the Center for Security Studies in Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. Paul, welcome to you as well.
Good to be with you, Jane.
So I'll start with you, Paul. I mean, it's been reported that the president was essentially dragged into this decision when critics, some of his advisors, even Bill Clinton, was pressing for more action. What's your reaction to the president on this issue after such ambivalence, it seems, over the past few months?
I think the president, quite appropriately, has had a lot of reservations about this, and I believe you're quite correct in characterizing what's happening here as an administration that is very reluctantly and in a piecemeal and tentative way responding to all this pressure to do something about a situation in which tens of thousands have lost their lives, and this naturally tugs at our heartstrings. But I think what the president is looking at, quite appropriately, is the question of exactly where do U.S. interests lie. This is a civil war with heavy sectarian dimensions, where there are bad guys on both sides, and it's really unclear exactly what U.S. interest would be served by getting more heavily involved in the conflict, or exactly how greater involvement, including arms to the rebels, would steer the conflict in a direction that would cause less bloodshed rather than more.
Michael Hanlon, how do you see this? Too little, too late?
I hope not. And I share a lot of Paul's reservations and the president's. But I think there's one more, even though I wind up being in favor of our doing more. But there's one more big question, which I'm sure Paul would agree with me about, which is where does it end? You know, if we start doing more, if we help contribute to the overthrow of Assad, which seems less likely now than a year ago, but if it does happen, you know, that's not going to be any more the end of the movie in Syria than the overthrow of Saddam was in Iraq. And so I think what's been lacking in the debate is a sense of the long-term complete strategy as opposed to just the next tactical step. Now, where Paul and I may diverge, I'm not sure where he is right now, is that I do believe we need to do more. And I think we have to envision a longer-term power-sharing arrangement, which probably is going to require international peace implementation forces on the ground. And this is a long ways off at the moment, but we have to talk about it in concrete terms early on if we're going to make clear what our role is. Our role is not a vendetta against Assad or his regime or his Alawite minority population. Our goal is a peaceful, stable Syria, and I think it's going to require international peacekeepers with some modest number of Americans at some point. If we're not prepared to sign up to that, then we probably shouldn't do anything.
Paul Pillar, what's your reaction to that? Do you see a long-term power-sharing arrangement, peacekeepers on the grounds for years to come?
Quite possibly, and I couldn't agree more with Mike that the question of where does this end is a key question. You didn't get in too much in your conversation with Clarissa Ward, the diplomacy, and I suppose we're going to have a little bit of that happening as we speak at the G8 summit in Northern Ireland, where, as we all know, there are a diversity of views on this question, where the French and the English have supported this latest move by the Obama administration to arm the rebels. The Germans are much more equivocal, and the Russians are very much opposed. But yes, the diplomacy is the direction in which we need to look. We had the breakthrough of sorts between Secretary Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov a month or so ago in arranging for what is still a prospective multilateral peace conference. There's a lot of disagreement about exactly who should be there. But I think that's what we have to think in terms of, and Mike may very well be correct that international peacekeeping forces are in the future of Syria.
Here's some sound from Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona. He's been one of the administration's harshest critics on Syria. Even after the decision to arm the rebels, he wanted more. Here he is on Friday on Fox News explaining why.
For us to sit by and watch these people being massacred, raped, tortured in the most terrible fashion, meanwhile, the Russians are all in, Hezbollah is all in, and we're talking about giving them more light weapons? I mean, it's insane.
Michael O'Hanlon, I mean, why this action now? Didn't the administration have virtually all the same evidence for weeks, if not months, about Assad's chemical weapons use? I mean, how do you see the reasons for intervention now?
Well, my interpretation is that chemical weapons, while they do put administration credibility on the line, are not really the central issue here. And the more fundamental development in recent months has been the reestablishment of battlefield momentum by President Assad, whether it's partly because of the role of Hezbollah and new arms shipments from Iran or possibly Russia, or primarily just sort of the ebb and flow of these kinds of wars, of which Paul is a great expert and has watched a lot of them. And there's no doubt that, you know, those of us who try to do military analysis from this distance in Washington have a hard time putting our finger on what will be the key determinant of the next swing in momentum. And I think what's clearly different now from 2011 or 2012 is that Assad, in fact, does have momentum, partly because it's become such a sectarian war. I think the Alawites, his fellow minority Alawites, as you know, the sort of offshoot of Shiism, a smaller fraction of the overall Syrian population, they've really come together because they're scared to death that if and when the Sunni-based insurgency wins, they're all going to be victims of retaliation. And so it's really taken on a classic sectarian conflict as opposed to, you know, an Arab Spring toppling of a dictator. And that really has intensified the Alawite commitment to fight. They've gotten some key help from outside, and the momentum has shifted. I think that's even more fundamental than the chemical weapons issue. Mm.
Clarissa Ward, jump in on that. Do you agree? You're on the ground. You've seen so much of this. Have you seen a battlefield shift, the momentum shift?
I think what's interesting as well, just piggybacking off of what Michael was saying, is the way that, you know, this is a narrative. Assad has essentially sought to make this a sectarian conflict from the very beginning. He was describing the rebels as terrorists before there was even an armed opposition, honestly. And he was kept on with this line to frighten Christians and also Alawites and the Shiites that, you know, this is a sectarian thing. These people are going to come and sort of burn you in your beds if they emerge victorious. And it has been an extremely successful campaign in that sense. He is almost, by virtue of his rhetoric and shifting the narrative that way, he has almost kind of made it so, in a sense. And you do see, when you talk to Christians inside Syria, they do tend to agree that they're very frightened about the prospect of a new sort of radical Sunni Muslim regime taking over. At the same time, many of them do understand that the Assad government has clearly crossed many red lines. So you have this sort of you know, essentially people battling for what they see as a question of survival. So it's very difficult when you're at that stage in a conflict where people really do see it as a battle to the death to try to bring everybody back from the brink and get them to sit down at the negotiating table. And this has been one of the real problems in terms of trying to entice the opposition to participate in these talks, is that the opposition is already lacking in credibility with rebel groups on the inside anyway. But if they were seen to somehow enter into any kind of negotiation with any representative of the Assad regime, they would be considered to be traitors, essentially. So it's very difficult to think, you know, as much as one would like to move forward to a diplomatic strategy and get all the world together and have all the heads around the table, the reality on the ground, certainly to the extent that I've witnessed it, just does not seem likely to create the conditions that would be necessary for talks like that to really bear any fruit.
Paul Pillar, do you agree? I mean, how do you see the diplomacy aspect of this?
Well, I think Clarissa Ward has aptly described some of the hurdles. There has been a lot of resistance, quite outspoken resistance, among some of the rebel leaders about the whole idea of diplomacy. And what you're seeing there on some of the rebel side is a mirroring of what you see, particularly in the Alawite community on the pro-government side, of great skepticism about any compromise that can really be reached. I think that is a mistake on both parts. I think along the lines that Mike was talking about earlier, with the aid perhaps of international peacekeepers, some new formula is possible. We should note that there are elections due. Whether they'll take place under the current circumstances is remains to be seen. But presidential elections in Syria. Assad's current term is set to expire, I think, sometime next year. And if a diplomatic process went forward, that could be part of the peg on which you could hang some kind of compromise, internationally supported arrangement in which Bashar Assad himself goes, but you have enough guarantees and enough compromises where both the Alawites on one hand and the members of the other communities do not see their lives at stake, and they do see a place in a future Syria.
Let me get some sound in here before we go to calls. Earlier last week, former President Bill Clinton was at an event that was closed to news cameras and microphones, and he was very blunt on President Obama's actions to date on Syria. He said Obama would be a total fool, his words, if he listened to opinion polls and did not act on Syria. But then on Friday, in an interview with MSNBC, Clinton was much more supportive. He supported the decision of President Obama to arm the rebels.
I think on balance, this should be seen as a positive story, that America has the information now about the chemical attacks. They clearly know that there are other outside powers involved trying to shore up Assad and his repressive tactics. And the president's going to be given the opportunity to talk to a lot of his counterparts at the G8 meeting. And let's see what happens.
Michael O'Hanlon, talk about some of the extremist fighters that we were talking about here. I mean, Clarissa Ward earlier talked about maybe we're overplaying a little bit the extent to which the opposition has become radicalized, the extent to which al-Qaeda is involved. Do we assume, whatever the case, that some of our arms will end up in the hands of fighters who don't necessarily have our interest at heart?
Yes, and I heard Clarissa say that, too, very compellingly, that even though we may not want to overstate the role of these extremists, they are probably a more powerful part of the insurgency than they were a year or two ago. Those are my words, not hers. But I heard her say as well that it's not realistic to believe that you can really keep arms entirely from any given group within the insurgency. There's enough collaboration that you have to expect some leakage. I think that's part of why the administration's trying to limit its weaponry to very light arms. But here, I'm not sure. I'm always in lockstep with Senator McCain on this issue. But I think he was right, even though he did it in a very blunt way, to challenge the intellectual construct of the administration that implied that a few more light arms will make a meaningful difference at this stage. And we may have to take some risks. I'm not sure we should take the risks with anti-aircraft weaponry because, of course, there you have the real threat of terrorist attacks. But and I realize some of these weapons can be jury-rigged to serve functions for which they were not originally intended. But I'm dubious that we can keep this all to the sort of AK-47 variety of weaponry just because we're worried about leakage. We're going to have to at some point decide, are we more worried about that threat of al-Nusra getting a few arms, or are we more worried about Assad winning the war? And it's a legitimate debate, but you may not be able to have it both ways.
And Paul Pillar, what happens in a few months if the rebels whom we've supplied with these arms are losing on the battlefield? Are we committed to them now? I mean, is this a slippery slope for the U.S.?
I think the slippery slope concern is a very legitimate concern. It would be an even bigger concern if the U.S. were to take some of the next steps that some have advocated, such as setting up a no-fly zone in either the north or the south. But even without taking that measure, yes, it's a very major question, what comes next. I would be surprised if the decision makers in the Obama administration are naive enough, if I could put it that way, because I don't think they're naive, to think that a minor increase in small arms to the rebels would be a decisive game changer. It won't be, and I don't think they believe it will be. And what they're doing now with this announcement over the past week is basically an incremental change, as you quite rightly described earlier, under a lot of political pressure from Bill Clinton to John McCain and many others to do something. And I think the administration is simply taking it one step at a time.
Let's get some callers in here. Deborah is first from Waltham, Vermont. Hi, Deborah. Thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I'm very, very concerned about this latest news that the United States is going to be arming the rebels, because I don't feel that the U.S. has a clear goal. If we knew that the rebels were those who would support democracy, then I would completely understand this, but we don't see that at all. We seem to be arming, and arming is only going to lead to more killing. We're also preparing. We've got Patriot missiles in Turkey, and we're planning to have them in Jordan. So my question is, what is the U.S. goal as we go forward? I completely disagree with the idea that we should arm these rebels.
Deborah, thank you. Michael, will you take that? What is the goal going forward?
Well, it's a great question, and I don't claim to be able to read the administration's mind, but I'll tell you what I think the goal needs to be. The goal needs to be putting out a meaningful concept for power sharing, and that recognizes these groups right now don't trust each other. In fact, they're lethally afraid of each other, and we're going to have to, therefore, have a peace implementation force, which, given the nature of Syria, will ultimately take some casualties. And it's going to only be possible once we have a peace deal, and that peace deal is going to require the rebels to establish more battlefield momentum, which means that we have to provide them some degree of arms assistance and perhaps down the road that no-fly zone and even perhaps some greater air involvement by our forces. Now, when I say our forces, I mean NATO and the Arab League combined. And I mean only after there's been a commitment up front telling everyone, including the Alawites, that we're interested in a power-sharing deal, maybe even some kind of a federalist structure like in Bosnia, where the Alawites would always have a sanctuary in case they're afraid of reprisal. If you're not prepared to put all this out, and obviously I'm speaking fast and in shorthand, knowing that you've got a lot of calls to take, but I think the president needs to give this kind of a broad, complete strategy for what he's after, because otherwise any given incremental step is not going to seem credible, and it's going to raise these worries that we're headed down a slippery slope.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the Obama administration's newly announced policy of arming Syria's rebels and what it hopes to achieve. Here's some more sound. ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos. Here's Florida Senator Marco Rubio, harshly critical of the Obama administration's response to the Syria crisis. When asked what President Rubio would do, this is how he responded.
First of all, if I was in charge of this issue, we never would have gotten to this point. We would have identified elements that we could have worked with, and we would have made sure that those elements, not the Al-Qaeda elements, were the best armed, best equipped, and best trained. That being said, I think we need to continue to search for elements on the ground that we can work with, and we should try to do the best we can to increase their viability and their strength so that if and when Assad falls, and we hope that he still will, they'll be the ones on the ground with the best ability to kind of manage a future, hopefully democratic Syria and peaceful Syria.
My guests this hour are Michael O'Hanlon, Director of Research for the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, Paul Pillar, a retired intelligence officer and now a non-resident senior fellow at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service, and Clarissa Ward, CBS News foreign correspondent now in Amman, Jordan. She's monitoring the civil war just over the border in Syria. Paul Pillar, let me ask you this. I mean, there are many that I have read and heard say that the U.S. has knowingly been holding back in this conflict, knowing that this is a potential quagmire. And well, let's just have Hezbollah and Iran get mired in that quagmire. We're going to stay out of it. I mean, has there been sort of a knowing sort of withholding of involvement for those reasons, Paul Pillar?
There is a legitimate Machiavellian argument along those lines to be made. And I think it's personally a mistake to say that, well, anywhere Iran is jumping in or Hezbollah is jumping in, we have to jump in on the other side. I wrote a piece a couple of weeks back pointing out that Hezbollah is paying a very heavy material price. This was mentioned earlier on the program. And if what we want to see is to Hezbollah to bleed, then probably the best thing we ought to do is just sit back and watch. I don't think this was the dominating calculation on the part of the administration. I think the decision process has been much more along the lines, as we've described already in this hour, of slowly responding to this pressure coming from all points on the political spectrum to do something about this bloody situation in Syria.
Michael Hanlon, do you agree? Was there some sort of cruel Machiavellian calculation going on here at the White House?
No, I think Paul hit it on the head, and that's the accurate way to think about it, that, you know, any way of thinking about Hezbollah or Iran's role has been, to some extent, a second-order consideration. And I think at this point, people are concerned that Hezbollah and Iran seem to be upping their role, whereas we have stayed reluctant. And I think that's part of what tipped the administration into action. So, yeah, I think they've been reluctant to think of this as a place where Hezbollah is going to bleed and lose influence. They're more worried, I think, at this moment at least, about Hezbollah and Iran helping Assad hold on to whatever power he can inside of Syria.
What about Russia? Clarissa Ward, let me ask you about this. I see a lot of comments on our website, one from Brett, how to deal with Putin. I mean, more broadly, Russia has clashed with the U.S. over Syria. President Obama, of course, meeting with Vladimir Putin at the G8 summit in Northern Ireland today. What is Russia's posture now on this?
I interviewed Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov just over a week ago, and, you know, on paper, I think the Russian position is we don't have any preference here. We're not playing favorites. We just believe that the priority should be to get both sides to the negotiating table, and then the phrase he actually used is justice can wait. In reality, the Russians are, of course, giving the Assad regime an enormous amount of support, whether it's politically or militarily, in the form of honoring these weapons contracts, and also logistically. You know, there have been numerous reports suggesting that the Russians are actually printing out the Syrians' currency for them. So there's clearly a disparity between what Russia says it is doing or what Russia says its position is regarding in Syria and the reality on the ground. But Russia does seem adamant and feels very strongly that you know, well, Lavrov was saying that he and Secretary Kerry really saw eye to eye on one thing, which is that it is essential to get both sides to the same table, because this is not going to be something that you can wrap up in a day or a week or, you know, in the space of a conference. This is essentially a first step in a very complex and murky future. I mean, we talked a lot about, you know, a future power-sharing agreement. Well, what happens to the Syrian army in that scenario? What happens to the mukhabarat, to the secret police in that scenario? Because many people inside Syria, and certainly most of the rebels, will not agree with any kind of system that allows those institutions that they see as guilty of war crimes to continue. So clearly, without getting bogged down in all of that, there are many, many more meetings and more diplomacy and more developments. This is
many more complicated questions. I hear it. Thank you so much, Clarissa. Let's go to the phones to Woodward, Iowa. Danielle is on the line. Danielle, welcome to On Point. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. My lefty, liberal, progressive principles are really challenged with this. I was horrified with Darfur, and I'm asking myself, what if we are challenging the Soviets on some level that we don't want to? On first analysis, McCain's idea of bombing the runways sounds really practical. But what's the equivalent of the Soviet MiGs today if we were to do that? And I mourn the youth in East St. Louis and Newark, New Jersey, that are in a war zone. And I'm asking myself, when do we stop trying to be all things everywhere around the globe and take care of our own children?
Danielle, thank you. Thank you very much. Paul Pillar, would you respond to that?
I think that's a very important and appropriate question. Neither we nor the Russians have an interest in resuming Cold War-style proxy wars, be they in Syria or anywhere else. And I might add, we really don't have an interest in having proxy wars with the Iranians either, our bête noire of today. We do share, going back to Clarissa's earlier comments about the Russian role, an interest in not seeing this war go on forever and not seeing instability oozing out of Syria forever. So it's a mistake, I think, to look at any one set of arms shipments, be they from the Russians or the Iranians to the government side, and say we do not have an interest in trying to bring this under control. I would say none of us have an interest in a proxy war.
After two long and difficult wars, Michael O'Hanlon, in Iraq and Afghanistan, number one, how do you sell the American people on more U.S. involvement of any kind in Syria? And secondly, I know that you support arming the rebels and slightly more involvement in Syria. What did we learn in Iraq and Afghanistan that would suggest that we're going to do it right this time, perhaps in Syria?
Well, we're not going to do an invasion, and we're not going to do a forcible regime change, and I think everyone's agreed on that. I recognize there are limits to my Bosnia analogy that I sometimes make in regard to this war, but that's the level of American involvement that I'm envisioning, which is going to – and frankly, this would be bloodier for us. We would lose people if we were ever part of a peace implementation force because of the presence of al-Nusra, because of the presence of some of the Assad hardliners that Clarissa mentioned a minute ago, that we would have to try to extricate from any new power-sharing deal, but some of whom might remain anyway. But nonetheless, the Bosnia mission, in which we ultimately deployed 20,000 American peacekeepers as part of a 60,000-strong NATO coalition, I think is the upper bound on what we would ever consider here. And I would hope to keep our numbers to no more than 10,000. And we would make it very clear that if the Arab League and if the NATO allies and if others were not prepared to deploy at least as large numbers as we, there could never be a peace implementation force with American participation even after a peace deal. So I think you set some of those constraints up front. And then it's still more than probably Danielle or Deborah before her are going to want to contemplate, but it is a plausible limit to the mission. And you've set out the limits of your own willingness to turn the tide quickly on behalf of one group or another. You've made it clear you're after some kind of a long-term power-sharing agreement once the parties are ready to do that themselves, once the rest of the world is prepared to help. And if you don't get all those conditions met, you don't deploy your own troops either.
Clarissa Ward, do you agree with that? Is there a plausible limit to how the U.S. gets involved here?
Absolutely. And I think that we have to look at it one. I mean, of course, it's so important to ask all the questions. Why should we get involved? You know, this is and to go through and envision every possible scenario and question what our strategic objective is here. But we also need to look at, okay, what are the perils of not getting involved? Because not getting involved has consequences too. And I'm not advocating one policy or another, but I'm just saying all too often we critique getting involved without looking adequately at the potential perils of not getting involved. And certainly one of the most alarming developments that I'm seeing on the ground here in the Middle East is this sectarianism is not something that's confined to Syria. It spreads like wildfire. It's toxic and it's dangerous. And certainly one can argue about the ways in which the best ways to respond to that are, but certainly I think the administration is at least recognizing that Syria is an incredibly important issue that has massive repercussions and ramifications for the entire region.
Here's Ryan in Lexington, Kentucky. Ryan, welcome to the program. Hello.
Aloha, Jane. Yeah, I would just like to say a lot of vets coming home. I'm a former combat infantry vet, Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't hear anybody asking the combat veterans, you know, how they feel about this whole thing. And as well, when is somebody going to make the connection in between the weapons in Libya pouring into Syria? Thanks, mahalo.
All right, Ryan, thank you. Michael, would you pick that up?
Well, first, I'm sure we all appreciate Ryan's service, and what he and others have done is on all of our minds, because I think you're hearing a lot of people who are very wary about, even myself, and I guess I'm the most interventionist of anyone so far in this program, with the possible exception of Clarissa. We're all aware of how much our troops have done, and no one wants to contemplate another mission of anything close to the Iraq or Afghanistan scale. I have talked to a lot of combat veterans, however, who I think hate to see the idea of a state as important as Syria going up in flames in the middle of the Middle East with the United States doing nothing about it, with all the hard-won gains in Iraq being now at peril, partly because of the collaboration between extremist groups in the two countries of Syria and Iraq, with Jordan, an important country for our interests, being destabilized by the influx of refugees from Syria, Lebanon also being at risk, the possibility of sanctuaries for extremist groups being created. And this just builds on Clarissa's point. What are the consequences of doing nothing or doing what we've been doing? And again, I don't want to necessarily take Ryan's sentiment and claim that it leads directly to any particular policy outcome. But I think we have to weigh all these consequences of not acting as well.
A lot of listeners on our Facebook page, online, asking the question, why are we doing this? Here's Geraldine Fitzgerald. She says, who gave the U.S. the right or responsibility to be the world's police force? Here's E. Stansberry, as if we've never been down this road before. No historical references, nothing learned from past experiences. Ha, a terrible idea, too much of a risk that we'd be helping Al-Qaeda. And on it goes. I mean, to that point, Paul Pillar, I mean, you know, a lot of people here wondering, do we have to be the world's policeman?
One of the things that comes from being a superpower is that our citizenry in general, and not just those on the neoconservative right, but in general, have gotten into this habit, which we've developed particularly ever since we've been a superpower, that when there's a problem somewhere in the globe, the first thing we ought to think about is what can the U.S. or what should the U.S. do to solve it? And that carries the assumption that it's, number one, solvable, and number two, that the U.S. can solve it, number three, that the U.S. has a responsibility to solve it. And I think all of those propositions are quite questionable. So we need to get out of the superpower habit of thinking that everything in the world is something that Washington has to solve.
Let's get one more call in here. Troy is in Iowa City, Iowa. Troy, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jane. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I do have a couple of questions. Why isn't Saudi Arabia or even Kuwait sending troops? And the next question is what will be the rules of engagement, like in Afghanistan, or would it be like the rules of engagement of Kuwait or maybe just Somalia, where we just stand there and let our troops get shot and killed because we can't shoot until someone shoots at us?
Troy, I appreciate it, and I hear you. Let's turn it to Clarissa Ward. What about Saudi Arabia and Kuwait? What about their involvement, and what about rules of engagement? Our time is short, Clarissa. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I would say Saudi Arabia and Qatar are already very involved. They're the ones funding and arming the opposition, but often they're working at cross-purposes with each other. Qatar tends to support Muslim Brotherhood backers, whereas Saudi Arabia has a sort of inbuilt aversion to the Muslim Brotherhood. So it's been quite difficult for people inside as they try to sort of circumvent the politics of that. In terms of rules of engagement, I don't think anybody is talking about having boots on the ground. And so hopefully it would not be a situation like that at all, like the one that Troy envisaged.
Let's get a final word here. Michael O'Hanlon, Paul Pillar, and then to you, Clarissa, quickly. Putting aside what you might want to happen, you aside, Clarissa, as a reporter, but Paul and Michael, what you might want to happen, what do you each think will actually happen in the coming months in Syria?
I'll begin. It's Michael Hanlon. I would say that it'll be incrementalism, and what the administration is likely to see. Paul was correct. I'm sure that most in the administration don't expect a rapid turnaround because we're getting involved. But the administration will have its perhaps best hopes dashed, and the peace conference won't make immediate headway, and neither will the battlefield momentum shift as a result of whatever limited role we play. And then they're going to have a real moment of truth later in the year. Do they up the ante and up the American involvement, or essentially concede that Assad may retain his momentum?
Paul Pillar?
I would agree with Mike. This isn't very uplifting, but I think if we address this same subject 6 months from now, 8 months from now, it's going to look depressingly similar to what we're talking about today. There will be a city here or a city there that changes hands, but I don't think this situation will be markedly different.
And Clarissa Ward, finish us off here. What do you think will actually be happening in Syria 6 months down the road, a year, 2 years down the road?
Well, 2 months from now, we will probably hit the 100,000 mark, 100,000 people dead. That's in about half as much time as it took to reach 100,000 in Yugoslavia. So, unfortunately, I'm inclined to agree with both Michael and Paul that you will see essentially this sort of tit for tat, back and forth, gains here, one step forward, two steps back, without any decisive victor. And that's part of the problem here. How do you sort of throw the balance one way or other? Or if you're not willing to do that, how do you get both sides to the negotiating table and try to build some kind of an agreement between the two?
Lots to consider moving forward. Many thanks to a wonderful panel today. Clarissa Ward joining me from Amman, Jordan, foreign correspondent for CBS News. Clarissa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul Pillar, non-resident senior fellow of the Center for Security Studies in Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service, among other things. Paul Pillar, thank you very much for your insights.
It was my pleasure, Jane.
And Michael O'Hanlon, director of research of the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, author of Healing the Wounded Giant. Michael, thanks to you. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.